And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Better stop what you're doing right now and go out and top up your car with gas. Well, better yet, wait till the show is over and then go out and top up your car with gas. Hurricane Rita is pushing its way towards Texas, and in front of it, pushing gas prices up, some say as high as $4 to $5 a gallon. Out in the Atlantic, the leatherneck turtles are affected by the storm, and in D.C. this weekend, well, it's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's been a tough 3 weeks since Katrina stormed into the Gulf Coast, and now we wait to see what Hurricane Rita will deliver. To everything turn, 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 is what the Ecclesiastes were warned. A time for every purpose under heaven. This is tough. A lot of our nation is suffering right now, and I can say in my life this is as bad as it gets, in terms of my own sense or foreboding. And yet, this is the stuff that defines a people and a time and a nation. And it's our time. Today, I want to add some stability in these times of great chaos, because in so many ways, life goes on. Indeed, today's in-depth report on an amazing research effort focused on the gigantic leatherback turtles and their extraordinary journey brings us a global perspective that is important to keep in mind as the debate over global warming and its possible role in the worst hurricane season in many years continues. We'll be talking with Dr. Carlos Drews from Costa Rica, who is heading up the project. In segment 3, we head on out to Washington, D.C., where I'm headed this weekend to talk with Elisa Gravitz, who is co-producing the Green Festival. You know what? Green festivals are feeling pretty darn appealing to a greater number of people each day, particularly as we are faced with reconfiguring whole regions of our nation. Millions of choices will be made. Let a major one be to rebuild green. That will be a focus of this event, and you are invited. So let's get on with the news, and then on down to Costa Rica. So first, the news. It's like a giant game of Captain May I, as people in New Orleans were given the go-ahead to take a few baby steps back into their city, and then were told, no, you may not. With a response from just about every level to Hurricane Katrina, somewhere between inept to criminal, and by the vast complexity of the disruption to towns, cities, and regions along the Gulf Coast, Hurricane Rita, which is barreling through the open Gulf waters, picking up steam and heading for a headlong surge over hundreds of miles of coastal communities, yes, Rita puts all plans on hold. Hundreds of thousands of residents from New Orleans to Houston and Galveston are heading out of town, having learned their lesson from Katrina. However, some unique problems are adding to the mass exodus. Gas availability in some areas is limiting travel, and at the same time, dramatically higher prices, in some cases over $5 per gallon, add insult to injury. Galveston, the site of the worst hurricane disaster, which destroyed much of the city in 1900 and killed 8,000 people, now perhaps may exceed even those historic landmarks. As a result of the century-old storm, the city built a series of levees to protect the island city. Able to withstand 15-foot surges, the prognosis for Galveston is sketchy at best, as Rita, currently rated at a Category 4 and even 5, pushes that limit quite naturally with surges that could reach 20 feet. Therefore, the city is evacuating. Undoubtedly, there is much more to the story of the hurricanes of 2005. In the aftermath of Katrina, initial reports document 44 oil spills within southern Louisiana that resulted in 4 million gallons of crude in one form or another that have entered the environment. The Coast Guard, which is tallying the leaks, says most were caused when either tanks or pipes ruptured. The Coast Guard claims that none of the oil made its way directly into the Mississippi. However, other residents are not quite so sure. The Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality emphasized that some of these estimates are premature. The total amount so far reported factors to about 75% of the oil leaked during the Exxon Valdez incident. Some of the larger spills include 3.78 million gallons discharged by the Bass Enterprise Production Company in Cox Bay, of which 960,000 gallons were recovered, 2 million gallons have been contained, and 982 gallons evaporated. In many cases, the spills mixed with the ocean surges and floods and became part of the toxic waters that are still being analyzed for their potential to cause illness and worse in humans exposed to these waters. The journal Conservation Biology reports that one of the first mass extinctions may be happening with little notice. Insect species may be dying off in record numbers. Some studies estimate that over 44,000 bug species may have disappeared in the last 600 years. Because insects have been only minimally studied and recorded, and with very little current field research monitoring the plight of the six-leggeds, many species have simply disappeared without any real fanfare. Many entomologists are reporting that certain insect species just simply have not been spotted in a very long time. But being scientists, they cannot claim that the animals are extinct. Factors leading to insect extinctions include the fact that many insects inhabit very small niches, which, when they disappear, simply eradicate the associated bugs. The effects of insect extinctions, unfortunately, can begin to be felt in populations of animals whose diets rely on them. This can lead to co-extinctions. At this time, there is really very little that can be done to truly verify what appears to be the beginning of a general collapse of living systems. In a related story, international conservation groups proposed a $404 million effort Monday to preserve frogs and other amphibians whose sensitive porous skins make them particularly vulnerable to even minor environmental changes. At least 43% of known species are declining in population size, including 1,856 that might soon become extinct. The greatest declines are in North and South America, Puerto Rico, and Australia. One of the main causes is a fungus that is spreading, but also habitat loss and degradations, climate change, chemical pollution, non-native species, and over-harvesting of amphibians for food and pets. The International Union for Conservation of Nature and Conservation International are looking to governments, private institutions, and individual donors to assist in funding this project. And next time you go out to buy some kitty treats, don't go shopping for kitty sweets. Biologists say that all felines, from lions to house cats, probably cannot taste sweets because they have dysfunctional copies of the necessary gene. And that's the news. Recently I heard about an amazing research project, visited the website at panda.org, and became instantly caught up in a wonderful opportunity to connect with 11 leatherback sea turtles, the largest reptiles in the world. So now we pick up the story.
I'm very happy that today we're receiving a call actually from Dr. Carlos Drews, who's the regional coordinator for the Marine Turtle Conservation in Latin America and the Caribbean. He's working with the World Wildlife Fund. He's calling us from Costa Rica. Dr. Drews, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you. Yes, I'm very pleased and all yours for this program.
Thank you very much. Well, your focus, I'm sure you have a lot of experience in many aspects of marine ecology and marine biology, but right now you're focused on turtles. That is really your expertise. And very specifically, what we're going to talk about today are the leatherback turtles. Why don't you give us a sense of these animals, describe them, and then let's talk a little bit about their behaviors and why this actually affects their survival and what how this actually directs your project.
Leatherback turtles are the largest reptiles on Earth at the moment. They have not been the largest always over the time of evolution, but today they are, and they are also the largest of all sea turtles. They can travel thousands of kilometers from the nesting grounds, usually in tropical areas, to the foraging grounds in temperate waters where jellyfish is abundant. Now, they do feed mainly on jellyfish. And these animals come back for nesting after a 2.5 to 4 years traveling tour on the Atlantic side or on the Pacific Ocean, and lay in the order of 80 eggs on each nest. They may lay 6 or 7 nests in total in one given season. And that's the reproductive effort for that particular season. Then they'd return again to the foraging grounds in distant waters. This means, of course, that the habitat requirements involves a whole number of nations, starting from the nesting sites as such, but then all the way across the waters that take them to the foraging grounds. For example, turtles nesting in Costa Rica can go as far north as Nova Scotia in Canada, or even the coast of Wales. Some turtles may travel from the Guyanas all the way to the western coast of Africa, and turtles nesting in the Pacific coast of Mexico can go all the way down to northern Chile. So any conservation effort has really to encompass the whole range of habitats necessary for these animals, and consequently a great number of nations that must be involved in this shared responsibility for their survival.
Yes, it's an enormous project. There's two real different populations, the Pacific turtles and the Atlantic turtles. Their status right now is quite a bit different. Let's talk about the Pacific, which apparently are very endangered right now.
The leatherbacks of the Pacific, of the Eastern Pacific, are the most critically endangered sea turtle population worldwide. They have declined over the past 18 years of something in the order of 90 to 95% at a main nesting site in Mexico called Mexiquillo Beach. We used to have 1,800, 2,200 females coming ashore on every nesting season. In the year 2003, when I visited this beach, only 6 females came ashore. And that's the extent of the decline also in the second most important nesting site, which is Costa Rica. So we are really looking at a species that is on the brink to extinction.
Yes, that is critical when you have 6 nesting females that you're able to identify. I imagine, therefore, that in that situation, the eggs are being gathered and protected?
Not necessarily. That particular beach is well protected, so it was not necessary to move eggs. And conservationists today are hesitant to move eggs unless it is absolutely mandatory, because the nest is doomed, for example, because of flooding or imminent poaching. That's because the hatching success tends to be higher, of course, if we leave the nests alone than if we put them in a hatchery. But yes, essentially every egg counts for the leatherbacks of the Eastern Pacific today.
Now let's switch over a little bit eastward towards the Atlantic Ocean and talk about the Atlantic population.
The Atlantic population is more numerous at the moment, and we have a variety of scenarios. In some beaches, they are declining still, whereas at other sites, they are starting to increase the numbers. So overall, we have a mosaic of scenarios suggesting that they are better off than their Pacific counterparts. But given the quantification of turtles dying, for example, in the longline industry, we feel that the Atlantic leatherbacks are undergoing extreme pressure from the world fisheries, and that we need to do something about it. So the idea behind engaging immediately in the Atlantic Ocean, even if we have set as a priority the leatherbacks of the Eastern Pacific, is to prevent that dramatic decline from happening, and ensuring that these populations in the Atlantic will be stable or increasing for the years to come.
Now, also for the listeners, let's paint a picture of this animal, because this is a very unique sea creature.
The leatherback turtles are most unusual. They don't have a hard shell, for example. They are all kind of grayish or gray-blue. That's the color of the skin, with some pink and white patterns underside their skin and under the flippers. These animals have an extremely streamlined body design, and they can travel at about 5 meters, 7 meters per second when they are riding the sea currents. That means they are not just passively being taken by the sea currents, but they are actually using their flippers to increase a little bit their speed as they move along. They are amazing divers. They can go as far down as 1,800 meters at times. So that's, I think, the record dive that has been recorded ever.
That's extraordinary.
They have to adjust to the increasing water pressure as they dive under, and they are very, very well adapted to an ocean environment. Well, the males are basically the same size as the females, but they have a much longer tail. That's the way to tell them apart, relatively easy. But as it turns out, we don't see any males coming ashore. The males never return and never leave the water again after they are born. They only come relatively close to the shore to mate with their females, but it's only the females that will be seen by the tourists and scientists alike when they go to nesting sites.
One of the amazing aspects of the leatherback turtle is the fact that it's a very large animal.
These animals can measure up to 1 meter 80 and weigh in the order of half a ton. That's 500 kilograms, 600 kilograms. They're very large, and that size really helps them make use of habitat in cold waters, because the relationship between the water, the body surface, and the body volume by the sheer size of the animal is convenient. They can maintain the water, the heat of their bodies and still be able to forage in waters just below 10 degrees centigrade.
Mm-hmm.
That's very amazing for a reptile, really, and scientists are starting to believe that the leatherback turtle has a system whereby she can generate a little bit of her own body heat through metabolism in a way similar to some of the most evolved dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's now take a look at the life cycle. The animals that you're studying start out on the Atlantic coast of South America. That's primarily where your work is focused. They lay their eggs. Let's talk about the female, because this is where this story becomes so extraordinary, because once they finish that mission, that is the laying of the eggs, then they take off on this extraordinary journey. Give us some highlights of what you're discovering about their life from that point on.
Yes. We have recently started to understand the movements of leatherback turtles, particularly in the central and southern part of the Atlantic, where they were really, by and large, unknown, by using state-of-the-art satellite radio transmitters. These transmitters are the size of a mobile phone. They are fitted to the turtle using a harness, a system of strings and an attachment system to the leatherback that does not harm them. And the transmitter will tell you the location of the turtle, the diving depth, and the speed of movement, as well as the water temperature, for anything in the order of a year to 2.5 years. And that's very precious information. We have seen turtles traveling from Panama all the way to the coast of the eastern coast of the United States, reaching nearly Canadian waters now. There is one. Another one was in New Orleans, just offshore New Orleans, at the time when the Hurricane Katrina hit that area. And we see from the movements of the turtle in the water that she was going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, basically taken by the incredible force of this hurricane in an area of about 100 kilometers in various directions in a very uncoordinated way. When the hurricane passed, she finally moved in a straight line towards the peaceful waters of the shore. That's quite extraordinary. I don't think we have seen that ever happening and being documented
That's
before.
Amazing. Mm-hmm.
Then we have another very unusual turtle that was tagged off the coast of Uruguay from a fishing vessel when she was caught in the long lines of that particular fishing vessel. But she was lucky. There was a conservation group called Carumbe on board of that vessel, and they fitted this turtle with a transmitter. She's now moving north and has covered nearly 3,000 kilometers in Brazilian waters, and we anticipate that this turtle will continue traveling eastwards towards the shores of Gabon and may eventually lay her eggs next year during the next nesting season in Gabon. So African turtles traveling to Latin America really shows how conservation of marine turtles is a transcontinental challenge.
It seems as if the turtles tend to be very individuated in terms of their migratory paths. Any idea, is that correct, or do they seem to follow patterns? What can you tell us?
Well, we do see very individual tracks at times, and previous research in the northern Atlantic has also suggested kind of a spaghetti pattern across the Atlantic Ocean. They seem to have individual preferences for where they want to forage. But when you finally look at the locations where they end up foraging, they tend to be all convergence zones where the abundance of plankton and in particular of jellyfish is very high. So we can look at satellite information, oceanographic information, and then anticipate roughly where the turtles will end up once they finish the amazing trip from the nesting sites to the foraging grounds. We can also see that some of these turtles follow underwater ocean ridges, where again you have upwelling of very nutrient-rich water reaching the water surface, and again the plentiful water, plentiful in jellyfish. That's what makes good foraging habitats for the turtles.
Do you know if they tend to travel in groups, or is it more individual?
They do not. They do not congregate or coordinate their movements. They are very individual animals. The only time when they kind of gather is when they are ready to lay their eggs, and that's when they come close to the shore. And if we're talking about the females returning to a nesting site, that's when they encounter a very high density of males. But for these animals, we don't speak of an actual social bonding, kind of group living. It's just the coincidence, the coincidence in space. If that's where the nesting beach is, that's where we're going to meet, and that's where we mate, and then we all depart again and do our individual lives as usual.
Now, also, I'm just curious, are you finding that these animals are coming back to a very specific beach, or is it more generalized?
The animals that we are tracking so far have not returned yet to the nesting sites. We will have to wait another 2.5 years to see that happen. But we know from the previous studies that they do tend to be faithful to the beach where they were born. Notwithstanding, we have already documented cases of turtles, for example, nesting in French Guiana during one nesting season and then going to Trinidad during the next nesting season. Mm-hmm. And some turtles nesting in Costa Rica may end up nesting in the eastern Antilles in the Caribbean during a subsequent nesting season. So the movements are not as predictable as it is, for example, for hawksbill turtles, who are extremely faithful to the beach where they nest season after season.
And then also, just in terms of the hatchlings, has anyone been able to study sort of their paths? I mean, is it an instinct to head to certain areas? And I mean, just curious what we know about how they managed to learn this process.
Well, we are all very curious about that, and this is one of the great mysteries of sea turtle biology. It is very, very difficult to follow hatchlings. They have not been tracked to any degree. The size, the sheer size of the animals does not permit us fitting them with any transmitters that will last for a long time. So we have a great mystery here, and particularly for leatherbacks, for which the juvenile stages are very, very little understood. We don't know where they tend to be. I think there are only 4 records worldwide of juvenile leatherback turtles being found. So we have a great black hole of information here, a great mystery. Speculations suggest that they orient themselves when they return to the nesting beach using the coastline patterns, but maybe also geomagnetic cues as well as the stars. This is these are the typical cues that migratory species utilize across a different range of animals. So we think that turtles are probably using the same cues, but yes, a big mystery is still here.
When we return, we find out just what these grand creatures must face to fulfill their ancient place in the grand web of wonder, when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.